I've heard this story that in ancient times, people of the earth believed that the world was flat, a big plain, and I think they didn't know where it ended, but they probably thought that it has some edge. I don't know what they thought about where it ends, but they were into exploring, but they didn't have fast vehicles, so they could only get so far. And then I think it was Galileo, is that right? Do you know Charlie, or who discovered that the world was round?
No.
Amerigo Vespucci?
Copernicus, Vespucian, Galileo. One of those fellers. It was a while ago, I think, but it was, relatively speaking, not that long ago. Probably there was a lot longer time that they thought it was flat. And I think maybe didn't even question that the world was flat. It's obvious, isn't it? Just look out there and look out over the ocean and where there's no mountains and it looks pretty flat from sea level. So more data came in, more exploration, and eventually a shift of perception happened across the whole world. And maybe that took a while. Maybe at first this was a completely heretical and unscientific view. The world is round. That's ridiculous, I'm sure people said. But eventually,
I think even the ancient Greeks proposed a curvature to the earth. It's just whether people believed it or not.
There's
some early pioneers in that.
I think it was a gradual movement, like many of these things. The early pioneers of a lot of these discoveries are often seen as crazy, insane, you know. But then later, more investigation reveals that the crazy ones were actually understood, and the normal ones were completely deluded. So I think this is often how things go. So with that in mind, I think we have many examples of this. We have our normal view is that I'm a person over here, and there's a world out there apart from this awareness. And it's even become somewhat a normal view to try to understand how a physical brain produces consciousness. Scientists are, looking into this more and more, and getting further into different pieces of the puzzle, but I think they will never get to the very bottom of this matter, because I think it's backwards. It's more the Buddhist view is that a non-material awareness is first and foremost and verifiable in our direct experience, apart from any theories. And that's all we really know, is that we're aware. Richard brought up not knowing this morning, but I think that's true, that we can't really know anything as a fact or any objective knowledge. But I would propose, in a way, the only thing that we can know, we do truly know, is that awareness is aware, and awareness is present. It's not even a matter of knowing in some conventional way. It's just the undeniable fact of our experience. We are aware. And then what if as we start to explore what we call the body as physical sensations, what we call the mind as thoughts and emotions, what we call the world as actually perceptions of color and sound and smell and taste, that all of those ways that we actually experience the body, the mind, and the world are expressions of awareness itself. The unborn, the undying, the unconditioned awareness that we might call our self. It's hard to get that out sometimes because self is this kind of loaded word in Buddhism. From the earliest teachings of the Buddha, we hear the Buddha teaching, all conditioned phenomena are not myself. When the Buddha first taught Anatman, no self, he taught it as form or body is not my true self. Feelings are not myself. Perceptions are not myself. Karmic tendencies, formations are not myself. And even dualistic consciousness, dualistic knowing of objects is also not myself or the self. So all those things are conditioned. They're born and cease, so they are not the self. But this doesn't necessarily mean that there's not an unconditioned, unborn, undying, so-called self. Capital S self. There's some debate in Buddhism about this. Some people say it just sounds too much like something graspable, so let's not even use the word. And some say, well, in our direct experience, what is this, the ever-present, unborn, undying, but clearly aware and awake? Could we call this our true self? So we have this story we started to look at this morning from the transmission of light, about the third Indian ancestor, Shanavasa, who asked Ananda, his teacher, what kind of thing is the original unborn nature of all things? All. What is the original unborn nature of all conditioned phenomena? What are they, all these conditioned things really? Ananda pointed to a corner of Shanavasa's robe, his okesa. And again, Shanavasa asked, what kind of thing is the original nature of all the Buddha's awakening? Or bodhi. Ananda then grasped that corner of Shanavasa's robe and pulled it. And at that time, Shanavasa was greatly awakened. That's the story. So, Keizan Zenji in Japan, many centuries later, speaking from the direct succession of Shanavasa's lineage, said, This robe, the kashaya, means broken color or unborn color. Truly, you should not see it really as a color. In one sense, there is the color or form of mind and body and the world, from the Buddhas above to the ants, mosquitoes, and horseflies below. all of these things appear to us with their own colors and forms. However, they are not truly form and color. Therefore, there is no world of suffering that we have to leave, and no fruition of the way that we have to attain. The world of suffering doesn't really have a color. We project a color onto it. And then Keizan says, though he understood in this manner, Shanavasa asked a second time, what kind of thing is the original nature of the Buddha's awakening? Keizan says, even though we're not confused in this matter since ages long ago, and this matter here is this word emo that Dogen and Keizan use, means like such, like thus. So colloquially means thus, but also thus or such in Buddhism means like reality, in ungraspable reality of suchness. So we could translate it as, even though we're not confused about such a thing, about suchness really, from long ago, if we don't realize its existence one time, we will be vainly obstructed by our own eyes. So we may hear this as, we get this idea, maybe we've heard this kind of thing in Dharma circles for a long time, maybe even. We hear about the unborn, and we get it. But if we don't realize the truth of this one time, really directly confirm and verify this, we will be vainly obstructed by our own eyes. We might say our eyes that see a world outside. Therefore, Shanavasa asked like this in order to clarify the place from where Buddhas come, or the source of all Buddhas. Remember, his first question was, what's the original unborn nature of all things? And his teacher pointed to a corner of the robe. He could have pointed to anything, I would say. He could have pointed to anything. What's the original unborn nature of all things? But he pointed to a corner of the robe partly because we heard the story that Shanavasa's name means natural clothing. He was born many lifetimes wearing this natural clothing. So we might say he pointed another meaning. We could say he could point to anything, but he pointed to part of Shanavasa's natural clothing. In other words, is just natural way of being. You yourself, Shanavasa, are the original unborn nature of all things. And then Shanavasa asked a further question, what's the original unborn nature of Buddha's awakening? What's the original unborn nature of all things? What's the original unborn nature of Buddha's awakening? That's like actually awakening to the unborn nature of all things. Take the corner and pull it. Welcome. What is the original unborn nature of all things?
Just your question. Oh, my goodness. You put me on the spot.
And what is the original unborn nature of Buddha's awakening? And then we, whatever we point at, we grab a hold of it and give it a pull. So Shanavasa asked this second question in order to clarify the source of all Buddhas, in order to let him know that Buddhas respond to calls and appear in accordance with knocking. Ananda showed him by grasping the corner of his robe and tugging it. At that time, Shanavasa was greatly awakened. So, we've discussed before, maybe you have heard of this term Kano Doko, the mystical communion between Buddhas and sentient beings, the sympathetic resonance between Buddhas and sentient beings, which he doesn't use this word Kano Doko here, but that's how I understand it. We're talking about this principle of inquiry and response. We wish to meet reality, so we put forth some effort and inquiry, and then reality meets us. But reality is always trying to meet us, but we can't really meet it until we want to meet it. Like that? That's Kano Doko. And Ziggy probably knows the source of this quote I thought of when reading this, because he says, the Buddhas respond to calls and appear in accordance with knocking. And I thought of that, I think in the Bible it says, ask and it shall be given, knock and you will be received.
Knock and the door will be opened for you.
Knock and the door will be opened for you. Is that from the Bible?
Yeah. Ask
and you shall receive, knock and the door shall be opened for you. This beautiful expression of Kano Doko. Yeah. We might say God is always lovingly embracing us, but we often don't care or we don't notice. But when we ask, when we wish to meet the Buddha, not begrudging our lives, wholeheartedly wishing to meet the Buddha, then the Buddha appears on Sacred Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place and says, I abide in this world without end, and by the power of skillful means, I sometimes can appear and sometimes not in accordance with the request. So this pulling the robe is maybe something like this. Kazan says, in order to let Shanavasa know that Buddhas respond to calls and appear in accordance with knocking, Ananda showed him by grasping the corner of his robe and tugging it. And it worked. Shanavasa was awakened.
So are you saying that the only way to make contact with this other world, the Nawali, this
the unborn nature.
Unborn nature, thank you. Is by asking or
something coming from our side. I think so. I mean, we sometimes talk about grace, right? Grace is like somebody who's not asking, just wallowing around in confusion, the light shines on them. Sometimes we do hear stories like that, right? Without any asking. So we might say then that maybe still in accord with this principle that their asking is simply their wallowing around in confusion, is a kind of asking.
So my thought is, my follow-up is that I have a sense that extreme or unordinary events could happen in a war.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could happen in any number of circumstances where you are forced out of your normal way of thinking. You didn't really ask for it. But conditions stopped your regular thought pattern.
So I think maybe by ask, we can understand that as an openness. How about that? Asking is a kind of openness. So it might come in the form of a you know, pleading or investigation, that kind of asking. But it might come in the form of, say, a near-death experience, something dramatic like that. Yeah, it didn't ask for. But in that, when everything's being torn away, right, that's a kind of openness. We're on our last thread of life, and it's like, okay, I surrender. A kind of a surrender is a kind of openness, and it sounds a little different from asking, but I think same spirit. We need some sort of openness, because I think often what happens in our ordinary life is we're just going through our routines, and the more we're just like kind of bogged down in our habitual routines, we're just not that open to something new, a new perspective. So something needs to shake us out of it. And that's partly why I would say we hold sesshin. It's something out of the ordinary, right? It's I find going into sesshin, like the couple days before, almost always, definitely this time, is stressful. Because I feel like I'm going offline for 5 days, you know. I do a lot of computer stuff, and yeah, I confess I checked briefly today to see the emails that might have come in, and there were some important ones about sesshin late last night. But offline, meaning in general, we're putting aside our usual routine and coming into this new kind of life, a simple life. And that will hopefully kind of shake up our routine a little bit. So it will help open us. It will help open us to the unborn, original nature of all things. So even just coming to sesshin is a kind of asking, I think, is a kind of inquiry. It's a kind of openness. And then we can further, within sesshin, like I mentioned this morning, we can investigate our own experience. For example, asking, is awareness present right now? Is an inquiry with, if we're asked very sincerely, then Buddha or the unborn nature of awareness can reveal itself to us by us asking, what is this awareness? Awareness is like, I am this. I've always been here. I am the nature of every experience you've ever had, but you've never actually stopped to ask who I am. So when you do, I say, hi, I'm here. You know, I don't, except you can't see my hand and you can't hear my voice. But I reveal myself. So, we have this. This is Francis Cook, who's a Zen practitioner, Soto Zen priest and scholar and translator, who died a few years ago. Translated this version. Thomas Cleary translated another version of this transmission of light. And this is a kind of commentary, loose translation, and kind of personal commentary on this transmission of light called Living Buddha Zen by Lex Hickson. Lex Hickson is an amazing character. Let's say something about him here. He's a like fully immersed himself in all these different spiritual traditions. Like not just dabbling and, you know, checking them out, but he's, you know, I think maybe his main thing in the end, he was a Dharma successor of Bernie Glassman in the Soto Zen lineage. And, but also he's a Sufi sheikh maybe, or some sort of ordination in the Sufi Muslim order. And also, what is it? Russian Orthodox Christianity, I think. I think even some kind of ordination in that tradition, and also something in the Hindu order. Also, he translates stuff from all these things. He translated the Ramakrishna's life story in the Hindu tradition. So amazing character, and I try to, let's actually go totally to the bottom of each of these traditions. What an interfaith spirit. Anyway, his commentary is quite lively and nice. And on this section, this is Lex Hickson saying, commenting on the story. Remember now, there's these two questions that Shanavasa asks. What's the original unborn nature of all things? And then what's the original unborn nature of Buddha's awakening? So Lex Hickson says, previously he contemplated unborn nature, while now when his robe is tugged, he actually feels its living touch. The unborn is concrete, not abstract, active, not passive. It is more obvious than the obvious, not esoteric. That's this direct tug. We're not just kind of pointing at something abstractly. That's the unborn nature of all things we can kind of point at. But what's the Buddha's awakening to that? That's like a living taste. Then we actually have to grab a hold and give it a pull. Something more direct than just pointing. And Lex Hickson says, how could limitless awareness constitute some beings and not others? Can there be more than one eye of non-duality, more than one mind of luminosity? A beautiful comment on this unborn nature of all things. It's the one eyeball of non-duality. It's the one mind of luminosity. There can't be more than one. We are all the one mind, the limitless awareness that constitutes all beings. But Shanavasa was particularly awakened to this when his natural clothing was given a tug. Yeah, the corner is where the vertical and the horizontal meet. It's the meeting place right there at the corner. We don't do here, but I've heard even at some small Zen centers, we could maybe try this sometime here, as I love Zen ceremonies. There's a tradition of the full moon precepts renewal ceremony that you, outside the Zendo, they do this at Tassajara, at least sometimes. You set up an incenser outside the Zendo, and anyone who has one of the patched robes, you on your way in the door, before you come in, you take a corner of your robe and you put some incense and you incense it in the smoke of the, to kind of purify the corner of, purify the whole robe by one corner. You actually do it with a couple, you do this one, and then you take this corner and you do the same, and then you take this corner. You can't forget that corner. And even if you don't have a robe at Tassajara, one of these kind of patch robes, people will just take like their sleeve. And so purify your natural clothing through one corner is enough. These little square patches in the corners here, we sometimes call the guardian kings. Even like that mat on the floor, that spotted mat has like these little square corners added in, and we could say it's the four directions, the guardian kings of north, east, south, and west, that that protect the natural clothing. So we, by taking care of them, we take care of the whole field far beyond form and emptiness. Sometimes we can just point to them. Sometimes we give them a tug. A little love smack sometimes wakes us up, yeah, when we're sleepy. Something to startle us out of the kind of like this underlying drone of like conceptual muttering going on under the surface, like, well, why is he like this and not like that, and I want to go home now, and I want to... Sometimes something can cut through that the undercurrent, and for a moment we forget who we are and what we were thinking. And that's a moment of freshness. That's a moment of presence. We're just here. So Keizong goes on, truly, though we're not confused about such a thing since long ago, if we don't experience it one time, we will not realize that we are the mothers of the wisdom of all Buddhas. So another translation says, we will not realize that it is your own mother that is the wisdom of all Buddhas. Sometimes the Prajnaparamita, the teaching of the unborn, is called the mother of all the Buddhas. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. She is a source of light. The mother of all Buddhas. We are the mother of all Buddhas when we taste this truth. Therefore, Buddhas have appeared in the world one after another, and ancestral teachers have pointed it out generation after generation. Although one thing, the original nature, is never given to another or received from another, it should be like touching your own nostrils by searching your face. Another translation says, like touching your nose, when it should be like, who am I? Oh, yeah, well, that's obvious. A nose, but actually I kind of like, maybe this is more literal, touching your own nostrils by searching your face. A nostril is empty space, right? You can't actually touch a nostril. You can touch the edges of your nostril, but the nostril itself is just empty space. You can't touch it. So that maybe is a little like a little Zen, one of these strange Zen phrases that is so sweet and endearing part of our tradition. Like touching your own nostrils when you search your face. Some direct confirmation that it really is all okay. This world is falling apart. Yeah, we're in a total mess. This can't be denied. It's just like it's all downhill from here. I mean, climate change is, people are saying it's probably irreversible, and we just go about our business as usual. So I think we're actually, we're in a mess. But we can realize this fundamental okayness. It's really all right. That's the unborn nature of all things. The practice of Zen, Keizan says, must be one's own practice of enlightenment. He's not afraid to say, the word here is Satori. So the practice of Zen is the practice of Satori. When you're enlightened, you should meet a person. And translator put in parentheses, a true teacher. It just says, you should meet a person. If you don't meet a person, you'll be like a bodiless spirit, vainly dependent on grasses and adhering to trees. So, have some taste and then like meet and together we confirm our understanding, because otherwise it might be slightly off, or it might even be on, but then together we celebrate it. So there's a phrase in the Lotus Sutra, only a Buddha together with a Buddha can fully reveal the true nature of all things. And Dogen likes to celebrate that line. Something about a Buddha and a Buddha. So, when you have some insight, when you have some taste of this, then meet a person. If you don't meet a person, you'll be like a bodiless spirit, vainly dependent on grasses and adhering to trees. So this is may call for a footnote here. Dependent on grasses and adhering to trees is a well-known Zen phrase. And now you too know this phrase. This is footnoting here. The direct reference is to the intermediate existence between death and rebirth. We talked about earlier, when the spirit wanders without support. Supposedly, the only support or refuge for the poor spirit is grass and trees, a kind of temporary shelter. So, and you kind of get that image, that wandering around bodiless. Shanavasa had his natural clothing, but this kind of spirit realm in between two embodied realms, where the spirit is looking for some kind of sustenance, and it, I guess, according to tradition, it kind of like hangs out around grasses and trees and shrubs. So it's kind of like not really a reliable refuge, but just a little something that it trying to get a hold in this kind of bardo realm. That's the original image. And then, however, Zen uses this as a metaphor referring to Zen students who've left the ordinary worldly life of just going about habitual patterns, and they've wholeheartedly begun Zen practice, but they've not decisively concluded their training yet. In other words, you give up one world of just going about our usual mundane attachments. We start Zen practice, but we haven't yet totally confirmed this unborn nature of all things. So we're kind of between worlds. Maybe Sashin feels like this sometimes. It's like it's kind of this. We gave up a lot to come here. We gave up a lot of our enjoyable activities of ordinary life to sit here day after day in this sore body. But yet we haven't, we feel like I'm maybe not really in touch with this unborn nature. So why am I doing this? I gave up all that for this? This is maybe like this in-between realm. So hard. I think just to do Sashin, we have to have this spirit of great devotion, to just be willing to keep sitting here. And some trust, I feel like trust coming from these ancestors are like, this is not just about toil and trouble and sore, but it's not just about that. We know that, or we probably wouldn't have come, yeah. But this dependent on grasses and adhering to trees is in a manner of speaking like these Zen practitioners hovering like lost spirits between these two worlds or lives. That's interesting. Well-known Zen term. So, and that's what's being said here, right? Even if we have some taste of reality, we should meet a person, another person. And if we don't meet a person, we'll be like a bodiless spirit, vainly dependent on grasses and adhering to trees. You should use this story to clarify the fact that you must not practice Zen aimlessly and spend your whole life in vain. Do not vainly express naturalistic views or put your own individual views first. I think that this naturalistic views is like something that was widespread in Dogen's time in Japan and Keizan's just a little bit afterwards, so it was probably still widespread, which is this kind of like, sometimes nowadays they call it Hongaku, or original awakening teaching, which is basically, there is the truth of original awakening, the unborn nature of all things. We're complete from the start. And actually, there's nothing that we really need to do to be Buddha. But this naturalistic kind of tendency was taking that teaching a little bit too far and saying, and therefore there's, you know, everything is perfect already, there's no reason to practice or confirm this reality. Even confirming it kind of makes it into something. So just, you know, stay away from any kind of spiritual practice, because that's like adding a head on top of your head. This kind of thing would be like naturalistic. And Dogen and Keizan were very much into, like, even though it's true, this original awakening, Buddha nature, the unborn nature of all things is pervading every moment of every experience. We have to, you know, verify this, confirm this for ourselves. So I think Keizan saying, don't vainly express naturalistic views or put your own individual views first. Maybe that is a kind of individual view, is it? Yeah, yeah, I got it. It's all fine the way it is. Complete. This is, of course, a very subtle point, because then you go to the other extreme and it's like, I really don't have it now. I'm not confirming it and I have to. So how am I going to do that? Then it's all dualistic again. So it's tricky business. That's why the practice of just sitting is the ultimate resolution in a way, because it's like, we're not trying to get anywhere or anywhere that we're not already, and yet we're not distracting ourselves in our usual just habitual routines either. We're sitting and sitting devotedly, even when we want to move, we keep sitting and we keep relaxing into it, not going anywhere, and opening and opening and opening. Knock and the door shall be open for you. The door is so heavy, we can't actually push it open ourselves. But we can knock. And then from the other side, creak! Whoa! Hi, are you Buddha?
No, you are.
Oh, that wasn't the response I was expecting. Thank you very much. I'll be going. I didn't really mean to knock. Sorry to disturb you. I'll be going now. Wait, just a minute. I was just about to sit down for a feast. Come join me. No, I don't have time. I gotta be going. Well, it's here. You can come in and house him if you want. You can even go straight to dessert. Just have the cake. Well, is it vegan? And gluten-free?
Oh, the sushi world. Go to the tavern.
Oh, the tavern. The feast is set appropriately just for us. Whatever we need to receive, Buddha offers. You may think, Keizan says, quote, the way of the Buddhas and ancestors distinguishes individuals and capacities, or another translation, the way of the Buddhas and ancestors is just for special people. We're not up to it. You may think that. Do you think that sometimes? Even I, wearing these Buddha's robes and stuff, sometimes think, nah, that way the Buddhas and ancestors is really for people more special than me. I'm not really up to it. And Keizan says, such a view is truly the stupidest of stupid views. He's a little bit hard sometimes. I think that's actually very, you know, stupid's a little strong, but actually it's a very compassionate thing, right? He's saying to diminish yourself is so off track. To think that it's something special, not for you. Just please don't go there. I hear him being very compassionate and strongly saying, please don't think that. Who among the ancients was not a body born of a mother and father? Who did not have feelings of attachment and thoughts of fame and fortune? However, once they practiced Zen, they practiced thoroughly and realized awakening. From India to Japan, throughout the different times of the true Dharma, the counterfeit Dharma, and the collapsed Dharma, enough holy and wise people to overflow the mountains and oceans have realized the result of awakening. You ever hear about that? True Dharma, counterfeit Dharma, and collapsed Dharma. These all teaching about the these three time periods of Dharma, where the true, kind of springing forth from Shakyamuni Buddha, the great awakened one of our Kalpa. When the Buddha was in the world, many, many people would just meet the Buddha and awaken to their true nature. And that's how Buddha is. Yeah. And then over time, that Buddha, Shakyamuni, stopped appearing in the world in the way that he was. And his practice continued, but over time, this proposal in some of the sutras says that over time that light of the Buddha's awakening starts diminishing, and then you have the counterfeit Dharma, which is like counterfeit money, right? It looks like real money, but it's not actually. It doesn't really have value. So this time period where everything looks just like the Dharma is happening, but there's no actual realization there. And then the collapsed Dharma, Mappo, where it's like, then things get really degenerate and it starts not even looking like the Buddha's Dharma anymore. And the proposal that when they calculate, when they ran the numbers and stuff from the sutras, in Japan they calculated that it was around the 10th century that began this collapsed Dharma period. So that was a widespread kind of theory in Japan when Dogen was around. This is degenerate times. And in fact, because of this naturalist tendency that was widespread, Buddhism was all over Japan, super popular. It was like the national religion, right? But it was corrupt. Partly based on, interestingly, based on this ultimate view of original enlightenment, things got really corrupt. People stopped having the motivation to confirm it because it's already all okay. So, and then the ethics degenerated because of that. And that's when the Pure Land School arose. We can't practice anymore. We're by nature degenerate, but we can rely on Amitabha Buddha with this total devotion to be born in his pure land. But Dogen and the Zen tradition did not agree. He said, this whole Mapo thing, this degenerate age theory is, it's only degenerate if you make it degenerate. It's very practical. It's not like, let's not just resolve ourselves because some sutra says this is a degenerate time, we give up all hope. In a way, this Pure Land School is, I think, in a way, skillfully based on giving up all hope. They're using the theory of giving up all hope to surrender the self to the other power of Buddha. But the Zen tradition was, of Dogen, was sometimes called self-power. But I think it's really more like the dependent arising of self and other power. It's where Dogen says, it's degenerate if we make it degenerate. We don't have to give up all hope. We can wholeheartedly practice the way, and we turn the age of decline into the true Dharma. That's in our noon service dedication, actually, this Dogen's teaching on these three periods. We say, we're making this offering to these 16 arhats that are like Dharma protectors for us. And we say, with their understanding and strength of these awakened beings, may the true Dharma be renewed in the age of decline. We say, right? The true Dharma is the original, the age of the true Dharma. May that be renewed in this age of decline through the wholehearted practice of us and all our arhat friends.
how deep in decline are there? There's a middle one and a little bad one.
Yeah. We're in the, according to this Japanese calculations, I think there are different calculations.
Okay.
Because in these Indian sutras, they don't maybe talk in earth years. They have other ways of calculating time. But in Dogen's time, they said it was just near the beginning of the third worst phase. And, of course, we're much later than that, so we'd be like, forget it. According to that theory. What?
Kali Yuga
is, I think, more a kind of from a Hindu or Vedantic kind of presentation, same theory. Call it the era of destruction. Yeah, and all these things go in cycles. So even though there's three periods, even in that theory, it's like, well, I think it's just, in a way, pointing out through observation how the world does seem to go in these cycles. Like, you get a really liberal government for a while, and then that's like, it goes further and further in that direction, and then it has to swing, it seems to swing back the other way, right? It gets really conservative, and then it goes too far that direction, and then it has to go back. And maybe just part of the unreliable nature of cause and effect. So Yeah, the idea is that Shakyamuni Buddha, as he goes further and further into the distant past, his dharma gets more and more dispersed, and then at some point it fades away, and we get into a big mess. But then there's another Buddha, Maitreya Buddha, of future birth, and the whole thing starts again.
It sounds like our micro experience on the cushion,
even. Yeah.
Personal
Kali Yuga. That's a nice point, yeah.
Bringing your asses through.
Yeah. Any day or any period of Zazen, we might even go through the true Dharma, the counterfeit Dharma. The true Zazen, the counterfeit Zazen, and the collapsed Zazen.
That's going to happen at 8:40.
The collapsed Zazen. And then, luckily, nothing's permanent, so then the true Dharma dawns on us once again. And this roller coaster ride maybe is part of the flavor of Sesshin. We get to go through it again and again, which is nice, because then when we're at the dip of the roller coaster and thinking, once again, why did I sign up for this again? I remember I had that thought last Sesshin on the first day or the second day. And then I remember on the third day it was different. Or maybe, actually the last Sesshin, I had that thought every day. But the Sesshin before that, I didn't. And one might say, actually every Sesshin has been the collapsed Sesshin. But actually, because I'm back here again, there must be an unconscious, crazy knocking to be back here again. I've never gotten anything from it. There's never been any good comes out of it. But here I am again. That's interesting. That's kind of nice, because now, I don't even get any credit for, basing my signing up on some past great experience. It just looks just plain old stupid. But in fact, this is my bodhicitta, my inconceivable aspiration. Put my name on that sign-up sheet without even knowing why. It's pretty cool. Thus, you monks who possess sight and hearing, you have eyes and ears and nose and so on, you're no different from these ancients. Wherever you go, it can be said that you are this complete person. You are Kashyapa and Ananda. There's no difference in the four great elements, earth, wind, fire, water, and the five aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, between you, your four elements and five skandhas, and shanavasas, and mahakashyapas, and Shakyamuni Buddhas. So how are you different from the ancients as far as the way is concerned? As a result of merely not penetrating this principle, penetrating is this word, Q, that can also really, I think more truly means investigating. And then diligently investigating is kind of like penetrating something, actually, right? As a result of merely not investigating thoroughly this principle and making an effort in the way, it's bendo, wholehearted, the wholehearted way, you will not only lose your human body, which is hard to obtain, but you will not realize that it is the expression of the self, capital S. This body will fade away anyway, but without fully investigating this, we will not realize that this body is an expression of the true self, the unborn awareness. How beautiful. realizing in this way that one should not be negligent, Ananda again took Kashyapa as his teacher, and Ananda also accepted Shanavasa. Thus the way of teacher and disciple was transmitted. The treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, which has come down to us in this way, is not different from when the Buddha was alive. Therefore, do not grieve because you were not born in the land where the Buddha was born, and do not regret not living in the time when the Buddha was alive. This is the Zen spirit of about these three times of Dharma. It's all perfectly available now. In ancient times, you planted the roots of good abundantly, and you deeply created auspicious conditions for realizing prajna, wisdom. I'd say, really? In ancient times I did that? But that is one story, that to be at a Zen sesshin, we had to have planted many, many good roots, whether we're conscious of it or not. From the Dharma perspective, this is like rejoicing in our past merits to even be in such a place at such a time. As a result, you are now assembled here at Daijoji. This is Keizan's temple. Daijoji means great vehicle temple, the Mahayana temple. But you are assembled here at Gyokuonji, warm jewel temple. Truly, it is as if you were shoulder to shoulder with Kashyapa and knee to knee with Ananda. Like that, yeah. Knee to knee. Shoulder to shoulder when we're standing for service, knee to knee when we're sitting on the tan. Thus, while we're host and guest for this one time, in later lives, you will be Buddhas and ancestors. It doesn't say that here, but that's a quote from Dogen's regulations for the Cloud Hall. When he talks about like the forms for the Zendo. He says, you know, don't spit at the Buddha and stuff like that. But he also says, for some inspiration, we are host and guests for now, but in the future we will all be Buddhas and ancestors. Do not get blocked by feelings about past and present, and do not get attached to sounds and forms. Do not spend your days and nights in vain. That's another quote from the Sandokai. We translate as, don't waste time. Literally it says, do not pass your days and nights in vain. Carefully make an effort in the way. That's bendo kufu. Kufu is Japanese for kung fu, which means wholehearted activity in the endeavor of the way. Dogen uses that, and thus Dogen's later heir, Keizan, also says, bendo kufu, wholehearted effort in the endeavor of the way. Arrive at the ancient's ultimate realm and receive the authenticating seal and prediction to Buddhahood of the present. I would like to clarify this story with a humble verse. Would you like to hear it? Keizan says at the end of every chapter. These are Dharma talks, I think Sesshin talks, from the 14th century. He finishes with a verse. Sourceless stream from a 10,000 foot cliff, washing out stones, scattering clouds, gushing forth, sweeping away the snow, making flowers fly wildly. A length of pure white silk beyond the dust. Immaculate light pervading everywhere, leaving no place untouched. Pouring over us like sweet dew. All we need is to open our mouth, just a crack, and let it pour in. May our noble and sincere intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.